I'm Richard Kimblin, and this is the Planning Podcast. I'm introducing you to the first of three How Did We Get Here podcasts. Each is aimed at those who might not have been in planning at the time that particular topic areas evolved and set the trajectory to how we deal with those issues now. The first is concerned with planning for development from the point at which localism became a thing. Daniel Henderson, planning and environmental barrister at Number 5 Chambers, maps out the key stages, policy change, case law and legislative action, which changed the way that we plan development. Let's turn to Daniel now. Daniel, hello. Good morning.
Good morning, Richard.
Right, we're going to start off with a statute with a slogan for a title.
Yes.
Which is that?
That would be the Localism Act, 2011.
Ah.
And the reason that we're looking at that is because it contains some of the most important provisions in force today dictating at what level plan making takes effect. And so it's an important element of the plan-led planning system that we have. And it's an inevitable question. With the introduction of the Town and Country Planning Act and the firm installation of the sort of plan-led system of planning, the inevitable question is, well, who is in charge of making those plans? At what level do we make those plans? Who gets to decide what's in a plan? And the Localism Act is that the reason for the last probably 12 years or so, that the answer to that question has been increasingly more local, neighbourhoods and local communities, rather than central government or regional governments. And so today we're going to look at sort of two features of that act that really bring about that significance, the repeal of regional spatial strategies and the introduction of the duty to cooperate, and a little bit at neighbourhood plans. Important to appreciate, I'm going to enter this as an early caveat, that casting a bit of a shadow over all of this is the 2023 Act, the Levelling Up and Regeneration Act, which will bring about some change. But for the time being, if we take it chronologically and see how we go, we might get somewhere.
Okay, well, we'll leave LURA for another day. RSS, for those who weren't around when we had them?
Yes, in essence, a sort of intermediate tier of plan making. It's sort of important to get a bit of context for RSSs themselves, at least in a legal sense. Prior to 2004, when they were introduced, we had a sort of notional regional planning tier, which was relatively thin and optional in any sense in terms of day-to-day decision making. We had a sort of general set of documents referred to as RPG, regional planning guidance. And the duty was to have regard to that, but day-to-day, that was essentially as far as it got. So with Section 1 of the Planning and Compulsory Purchase Act in 2004, we got regional spatial strategies. And the idea, effectively, was a recognition of the need to coordinate certain planning issues that operate cross-border between local authorities. So things like strategic growth, environment, housing, infrastructure, things that have impacts across local authority borders, but which affect different parts of the country differently. And so what we had with the 2004 Act was a big reorganisation of regional planning guidance into these RSSs, regional spatial strategies. We also had the creation of what we call regional planning bodies. And they were basically bodies comprised of people with expertise in planning whose job it was to keep these things up to date. So in essence, they were this new middle tier between national policy, which wasn't then the NPPF, but became the NPPF, and local policy to give some level of coordination without complicating things too much in theory.
Okay, so we understand their function, the way in which they were made, who was making them. What about the political context? Do you want to say something about what was going on towards the end when they were starting to become unpopular? And what was going on at the time that they ultimately came to be abolished?
Well, that's the really significant point, because the political context for this is all so important. So obviously in 2010, we had a new government, the new Labour left us and replaced by a coalition government. And without wishing to induce too much PTSD, we had the phrase the big society, which came to dominate politics and came to be completely ubiquitous. And the Localism Act was a big element of that policy. And you can see a number of themes in the Localism Act that were central to the big society, chiefly decentralisation. So a sort of major campaigning slogan for the Conservative Party, particularly, which dominated that coalition government, was this idea that we needed to cut out red tape, that we needed to democratise things like the planning system, that we needed to cut out bureaucratic top-down plan making, and that we needed to give sort of power to the people. And so that's where the Localism Act came from, the idea that we needed to give individuals at a local level more control over major planning decisions affecting their area. Part of the idea, part of the thought process, was a desire to make planning decisions less contentious. And the idea was that because things were all so top-down with regional spatial strategies, the number of objections to planning applications went up because it was all imposed. We can probably draw our own conclusions about whether it's been effective at removing acrimony from locally significant planning applications. But certainly the principle was one of democratisation. And you can see that throughout the Act, because the Localism Act isn't just a planning act at all. It's an act that does all kinds of reforms to local government. And one of the key players in proposing the legislation was Greg Clark, who at the time was Minister of State for Decentralisation, which tells you all you need to know about the sort of central themes of the Act.
And when you turn up your 2012 framework, you get to see his lovely picture on the front page.
You do indeed, and that's a treat for all of us.
The question of abolition, how did abolition come about?
I think it's fair to say in fits and starts. There was, as part of regional spatial strategies, a little section squirreled away at the end of the snappily entitled Local Democracy, Economic Development and Construction Act 2009, which I'm sure we all have a copy of. And section 79.6 of that act effectively gave the power to the Secretary of State, who at the time was Eric Pickles, to revoke RSSs if he thought it necessary and expedient to do so. And on election, he thought it necessary and expedient to revoke all of them. And so in one fell swoop in July 2010, we had all RSSs and the entire regional planning tier revoked by way of ministerial statement. That generated a level of controversy, in particular amongst home builders and Calla Homes, who ended up on the wrong side of the decision to do so in the context of a planning application that they were making. They challenged the decision to do so on what we call a Padfield challenge, i.e. using a statutory power for an incorrect purpose. And the argument went, well, just because you've got this little power at the end of the Act to repeal certain RSSs that aren't working doesn't mean Parliament intended to say, do away with all of them without asking us. And the High Court agreed. And Mr Justice Sales, whatever happened to him, essentially concluded that that was correct and quashed the decision to do so. So ultimately, it had to be in statute. And Section 109 of the Localism Act did exactly that, repealed RSSs as a concept. It wasn't hard-edged. It wasn't a they're all gone now. They were gradually phased out, which is obviously necessary to stop utter carnage erupting. And they were gradually phased out until around mid-2013. But certainly by mid-2013, we were fully in the throes of the duty to cooperate.
So what you can see there, I think, is an expression of why those who want to promote development were keen to retain the RSS and are keen to see the return of regional planning. It's absolutely spot on to observe that it was a house builder that brought that challenge. And what was going on there was essentially that Carla Holmes needed that part of the development plan, RSS absolutely. Being part of the development plan, to support their proposal, absent which they had rather less development plan support.
Absolutely.
Fascinating piece of litigation. In the end, they didn't get home with their homes.
No.
Very, very interesting Court of Appeal judgment, which kind of skewered that. But yes. That's a slightly niche point. So that's RSS gone. Mr. Pickles back on track. What's next?
Well, what's next is two-pronged in a way, but centrally is the duty to cooperate. A well-known phrase that's been uphill and down dale. What is the duty to cooperate? Most importantly, it's a legal duty. Not a policy duty, which is a distinction that we'll come to talk about. But what it did was insert a new Section 33A into the 2004 Act to cooperate with other local authorities to, quote, maximise the effectiveness of a variety of activities. And already we can see all kinds of questions popping up about what that actually may mean. At its heart, those activities were the preparation of local plans and other elements of the development plan that went to that, and any activities leading up to that. And the focus, at least in theory, was sustainable development. The long-form title of the section is the duty to cooperate in relation to planning of sustainable development. But the obvious question is, well, what does it mean to cooperate? What does a local planning authority have to actually do? And there is some assistance in the Act. First, we're told by Section 33A2 that it means to engage constructively, actively, and on an ongoing basis. Well, what does that mean? What does it mean to engage constructively, actively, and on an ongoing basis? Well, we're further told by subsection 6 that it requires considering whether to consult on and prepare and enter into and publish agreements on joint approaches to the undertaking of the activities that we talked about, the development of local plans, and considering whether to agree under section 28 to prepare local development documents. So I think what you can see straight away is that it's much less mandatory in terms of result than RSSs were, and much more about encouraging diplomatic working together between local authorities to produce some sense of a regional planning tier via local plans.
Do you want to say anything about what the judges have done to help us with what that means?
Well, I think the hope is always with slightly vague statutory language, that the High Court will get stuck in and help us out with exactly what these principles mean. The general approach of the High Court in relation to the duty to cooperate has been pretty hands-off. And that might be no great surprise, because the language is all steeped in planning judgment. And so the reality is that the vast majority of challenges to inspectors' decisions on whether or not the duty has been complied with failed. It's not been entirely without guidance. There's a series of cases that give us some guidance on what inspectors at plan examination should actually be looking for. And a very often quoted bit of guidance is Mr. Justice Sullivan in Central Bedfordshire. And he said, and it's useful to quote the full passage, to come to a planning judgment on a duty to cooperate involves not a mechanistic acceptance of all documents submitted by the authority, but rigorous examination of those documents. And he went on to say the key phrase, in my judgment, is active and ongoing. So the High Court didn't leave us completely high and dry, but they were certainly well aware that the principal focus and the principal stage at which the decision on whether the duty had been complied with was taken is always with inspectors, and that they're not going to get involved with that unless something's gone really wrong.
Now, it doesn't take very long searching for people's opinions on the duty to gain an impression that it has some difficulties attached to it.
Yes, to put it mildly.
I'm not expressing a view one way or the other, but tell us, compare the theory with what might be said about the practice.
Yes, that's a fair and balanced summary, if I may say so. The theory, I think, there's an element to which that depends on your politics, but the theory is great. This utopian ideal of local authorities working together to develop a system of planning whereby it isn't imposed from the top, whereby local people get to decide local issues, but they do so in a way that all ties together nicely at a regional level. However, politics does take hold. One of the big battlegrounds that listeners will be very familiar with has been over housing. And we've seen over the years a series of local plans fail, particularly a big spate that failed in 2020, largely because of a failure to engage adequately with the need for housing in their area and in neighbouring areas. And that's perhaps no great surprise when one thinks about it. All of the, particularly those that failed in 2020, certainly in St Albans and Sevenoaks, were in areas where there is a shortfall of housing. And the reality is that it's very hard to say to a local authority that you ought voluntarily to accept shortfall in housing stock from other local authorities, particularly when you, as a local authority, are under pressure with housing already. And secondly, I think, as the courts have also made pretty clear, it is only a duty to cooperate. It's not a duty to agree, and it's not a duty to take any action. And so the reality is that even 100% compliance with the duty, even if you have been to your partner local authorities and you have said, well, we need to do X, Y, Z, and you've come up with a document that says, yes, we need to do X, Y, Z, don't actually have to take any action as a result of it, and you've complied with the duty. So the theory is good. In practice, as many of these things do, it's probably not unfair to say a number have hit the buffers as a result of the influx of local politics.
So neighbourhood plans, utopian, as you've put it, or that the hyper-local tier, as I know you've referred to it. What about where we are today with those? Do you want to say something about that in the context of our run into this and as to how we've got to this point?
Well, it's important to think about neighbourhood plans a little bit, because of course the repeal of RSSs is in a sense two-pronged. With RSSs, you had regional policies which were part of the development plan. And with the duty to cooperate, you replace regional policies with local policies with a regional aspect. Question then is, what happens to the development plan? Local plans obviously still pass the development plan, but the Localism Act went even further and introduced this bottom tier to the development plan of neighbourhood plans, which, yes, hyperlocal, which is a phrase that I take full responsibility for, a hyperlocal aspect of plan making. And in terms of where that leaves us today, putting Lura on ice for a second, what I think we see from the Localism Act is it's another way of trying to resolve an inexorable difficulty that the planning system, to some extent, as soon as it's plan-led, is always going to have. Because on the one hand, you have the recognised importance of local decision-making. I don't think anyone would dispute that up to a point, it is sensible and reasonable to give local people some level of control in the development of their local area. And we see elements of that in all kinds of elements of the planning system. That's why we have duties to consult. That's why we have the existence of local plans at all. There is recognition that local people ought to have some level of say in what goes on around them. But on the other hand, even the Localism Act recognise that to solve broader national problems, particularly in relation to housing, you're going to need local authorities to work together in some way, cross-border, to get to some kind of solution. And it's ultimately a balancing act that's oscillated over the years, and with the Localism Act came down very heavily in favour of local. I think the general view, as you diplomatically put it, is that the duty to cooperate probably isn't the way forward long-term. It perhaps doesn't have the teeth that you might need to recognise and affect the importance of cooperation. But equally, RSSs weren't necessarily a complete answer either. They were quite top-down. Some may think, again, that's really a political question, that they weren't especially democratic, and they were a little bit clunky in places. Ultimately, it's trial and error, a little bit, and working out on what level we are defining that middle tier of planning, how far we want to push local authorities into cooperating with it, and how much top-down we're prepared to tolerate. But that's all been redone with Lura anyway.
So let's take Lura off ice.
Let's take Lura off ice.
What do we anticipate the fate of the duty to cooperate to be, and how, in brief, do you see that working out?
It's all change, again. The duty to cooperate is from a date to be appointed, as with so much of Lura at the moment, to be repealed by Schedule 7 to the Act. And what we're going to get instead is a new acronym, which I'm sure will bring a festive cheer to the profession, Joint Spatial Development Strategies, JSDSs, which I already can't say. So what we're going to get, essentially, is a big chunk of the 2004 Act is going to be replaced with a new list of sections, from Section 15A right through to 15, I think, LH, which gives you some sense of the level of detail that's involved. At the broadest level, probably the most important word in all of that new reform is in Section 15A, which reads, two or more eligible local planning authorities may agree to prepare a JSPS. And so while we can see there's a tremendous amount of detail that will kick in if local authorities decide they do want to produce a JSPS, it is wholly optional. They will be part of the development plan. We get a little bit of a clue as to what they're likely to contain from the Section 15AA. In essence, it's a may include and a must include dichotomy. What they must include is as vague as you could possibly get. The statutory definition boils down to essentially things that we consider strategically important as a local authority, which might be thought to be the point anyway. The may include gives us a little bit more detail. We're told that they may include infrastructure, provision of which is of strategic importance for facilitating development, for, interestingly, mitigating or adapting to climate change, and for promoting or improving economic well-being of the area. Perhaps most interestingly, they may also specify or describe affordable housing provision, if local authorities consider that to be of strategic importance. Will it work? Will it help? Remains to be seen. There is a concern, which is probably reasonable, that it's not likely to be that much more effective in and of itself, because it's voluntary. At least with the duty to cooperate, it was a duty, and it was a duty that by which local plans could live or die. If they do become a more wide-ranging feature, they may become more effective because they may actually have an impact in the sense that it's more than a duty to just check in. It is actual policy being produced. It's also important to bear in mind, of course, that Lura is a massive document with all kinds of different reforms to the planning system. So how that all glues together remains to be seen. Certainly it's another go. It's another go at resolving that inexorable problem.
inexorable problems. I hope it isn't, because we need plans to live, not die. Let's see. But Daniel, thank you very much indeed for a whirlwind tour from Eric Pickles to Laura. So thank you ever so much.
You're
People
nice
will one. Love that.
Thank you very much indeed, Richard.
Goodbye. That was the Planning Podcast from Number 5 Chambers, and next is the second in our trio, where we're going to turn to planning and habitats with Jess Allen.